Kenzie, what a great children's moment. That was just fantastic. I was just busting in that front pew. I just wanted to start singing. We're following the leader, the leader, the leader. We're following the leader. What movie is that from? Peter Pan, the Disney version of Peter Pan, which I understand is about to get pulled or has been pulled because of its overt political incorrectness. That's the world we live in. And I think we should be sensitive. I think there's a place for that. I think absolutely. Sometimes I wonder if we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. There was a book that was written, I think, late 80s, Parenting Isn't for Cowards. It was written by James Dobson, who, for his far right-wing political views, has been black-marked, black-balled, scourged, become a scourge, purged, whatever it was. He's out. Very, very limited influence, nothing compared to what he once had. The book he wrote actually got renamed because it met with strong opposition. It got changed to Parenting Isn't for Anyone. But I thought, what a provocative title. Now, I will admit, I never read the book, so I don't know what was in there that bent people out of shape or not, but I thought, what a compelling title. Parenting Isn't for Cowards. Parenting Isn't for Anyone. My experience, that's pretty true. There's days, and I loved your point, Veronica. Can we just replay that for everybody on a loop afterwards, Bill? Obey your parents. Follow your parents. Not just for little children, 20-somethings, especially relevant. Your parents are brilliant. You should listen to them in all things, all times, without question or reservation. Well, maybe not totally. Sometimes we mess up because we're human. We're human. But I thought it was a pretty fantastic point, Veronica, that Jesus is our leader. Jesus is the one we follow. But it should be said, I think perhaps noted, that Jesus blazed a trail that was pretty steep and pretty narrow. It was a hard trail. Before I was ever a Christian, I didn't even know that Circle Square was a Christian thing, but it was the only thing with cartoons that we got on a Saturday morning, so I was in. They had puppets and they had cartoons, and it was great. And I remember this one cartoon that they had about following Jesus, and there was this young fella, I don't know if he was teen or just a young adult, but he's called to follow, and he's got a choice of two paths, and one's like a super highway. It's wide and it's paved, fresh blacktop. You remember those days when we got on a highway with fresh blacktop? Were we not obligated to see how fast our car could go on that nice smooth surface? We were, well, some of us were. Definitely Rod, not me. I would never do anything that risky. Superhighway led to a Las Vegas type city, but in the end, that city led to a place of destruction. And then it kind of goes back, and he has another choice, and he can go up this steep, rocky, craggy goat trail, climbing, scraping, getting cut, slipping, bruised. But when he gets to the top, there's this incredible golden gate. And that's kind of the Christian path, I suppose. That's the road that we're called to travel, the narrow road, the difficult road, the steep road. But who likes that? We like things that are easy, right? I don't know how many times I've bombarded with the same commercial on my little YouTube feed about, you know, the little one from the Dragon's Den where you swallow a pill, you put it in water, you stir it, and you swallow it, and all your adipose tissue melts away. I'm thinking, yes, sir, that's for me. I remember back in the 70s, my buddy Joey's mom had one of those machines where you strap the belt around your backside and it just goes crazy and just beats the extra weight off your hips. We had a lot of fun with that machine until she caught us. That brought that joy to an end. We want the easy road. We want the easy way. We want the easy things. But the Christian life isn't easy. The Christian life was never supposed to be easy. And Jesus says as much in the passage that we have before us today. Before we ever cross over to the promised land, the proverbial promised land, we have to walk the footsteps of Jesus. And you might just remember that Jesus warned his followers to count the cost. Before you pick up that cross and follow me, count the cost. Because this road leads to Calvary. And what happens at Calvary? They don't roll out a red plaid blanket and have a picnic with fried chicken and potato salad. Where does this road go? What are you called to do? What does it mean to follow Jesus? And so if you were here last week, you remember our exploration of those first 14 verses. But what happens here after breakfast, Jesus finishes eating and he engages Peter. He engages Peter directly and specifically. And what follows is precisely what Connor read for us. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter. And I think we've all had those moments, haven't we? Or most of us had those moments where we've had the big meal and we've had people around us and we're all sitting back and we're having our coffee and our cake and it's kind of wrapped up, but now we're visiting. This is the visiting hour. This is supposed to be the happy time. And it is and it isn't for Peter, because this is what happens next. Jesus says to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. You know all things. You know that I love you." I think there's really three important things to observe in these three verses. What happens in Peter is he gets a chance to make this declaration of commitment. That's really what Jesus is evoking from him here. He's drawing this out, a statement of commitment. But I think there's three things that we need to, should, can, want to observe. And the first is when he says to Peter, "Do you love me more than these?" The question is, what are the these? George Beasley Murray is who I'm quoting here, but he argues, the context must surely mean more than your fellow disciples do, rather than more than you love them, or more than you love your fishing equipment. Because those are the other theories. Do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than your fellow fishermen? But that's not what Jesus is saying. Another way we might interpret is, do you love me more than all your fishing stuff? But that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying something very pointed, and he's dragging out the past. He's saying, do you love me more than these other people love me? Because you will remember, perhaps, that if you're looking at John 13 or going back to Matthew 26 and verse 33, Peter has these moments where he says, "Jesus, I love you. I will go to the mat for you. I will follow you up to Calvary. I will die with you, Jesus. If everybody else should fall away, I will still be there, right to the bitter end. I will be standing with you." And, well, that kind of fell short, didn't it, on the night Jesus was arrested. I think it's something that Luke, Jesus tells Peter, you're gonna be sifted. Satan has asked you if he can sift you as wheat. You're going to be tested, you're going to fail, but you're going to be restored. And this is the restoration. And he's kind of shoving this back in Peter's face a little bit. Peter, you said you'd love me more than everybody else, but you bailed on me, mister. So let me ask you now. Do you love me more than these? And all Peter's got to say back to him is, Lord, you know I love you. But he's not comparing himself to everybody else at this point, is he? He's going to have that moment very, very, very shortly. He's going to have another one of those I don't like John moments, but right now, he's not willing to put himself up against everybody else. Jesus brings him back to the past. And then Peter says, you know I do. And Jesus says, what does he say? He says, feed my lambs. In fact, of the three times that he asks him, he says, feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. I think this is the second thing we should observe here. Whose sheep? Whose sheep? They're not Peter's sheep. They're Jesus' sheep. I think that has strong implications. If I ever got to speak at a pastor's conference, I think I would bring this up. Y'all ain't my sheep. You're Jesus' sheep. I got sent in to take care of y'all, but you're not my sheep. You belong to somebody else. It's my job to look after you with the full knowledge that I'm going to have to answer to Jesus for the way I've taken care of you. Did I look after you? Did I feed you? Did I protect you? Did I do the things that a shepherd's supposed to do? Or did I use you and abuse you and make you a stepping stone for my pastoral career? Did I love you? Did I love you the way Jesus loved you? I had a colleague who once had a sign in his office that said, if you want to be a shepherd, you have to be able to stand the smell of the sheep. Because most sheep on most days are pretty good, but some of you can be a little stinky sometimes. Feed my sheep. Take care of my sheep. Peter doesn't lose this lesson. In 1 Peter 5:4, he says, and when the chief shepherd is revealed, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. You elders, you're supposed to take care of God's people. And when the chief shepherd comes, you'll get that reward. But I think it behooves anybody who stands in the pulpit, anybody who occupies a chair that says pastor somewhere on the door, to remember the congregation, the sheep, the lambs, they belong to Jesus. And so even in that, coming back to Veronica's very well and clearly explained children's story, who are we following here? It ain't Norm. It ain't Ben. We might be inclined to follow Herman because of the great example he's set. But really, Herman's just a man too. We're supposed to follow Jesus. And thirdly, Jesus provides redemption by giving Peter the opportunity to reprofess his faith. Woo! Every once in a while you write sentences that not even you can say, hey? I've talked about this before. Pastor Kurt preached a brilliant message on this a few months ago, that Jesus denied, or Peter denied Jesus three times, and now Jesus is calling forth a commitment three times. Incidentally, and interestingly enough, according to John, how many times does Jesus reveal himself to the disciples? Three times. To the denier, to the doubter, to the cynic, three times. John loves the number three. And here we have it again. To quote Colin Cruz, he says, Jesus may have given Peter three opportunities to re-express his love for him and recommission him three times as well because of his threefold denial. The record of Peter's reinstatement stands as an encouragement for all who might crack under pressure and deny their Lord. This is not the same as cold-blooded apostasy. It is not regarded as such by the Lord. Following Jesus requires a commitment. And when Peter's feet were put to the fire, he failed. But that didn't mean that he was written off the page. In fact, as soon as we turn the page, we see that he is reinstated, redeemed, restored, given that place again. And friends, I can tell you, perhaps you have had a moment in life where you think, I have messed up. I have made a complete mess of this situation, and there's no way that Jesus can still love me. There's no way that he could still want me. There's no way that he could still use me. There's no way he would use me. I am broken. I am ruined. I'm no good anymore. And that is a lie of the devil. That is a lie emanating straight from the pit of hell. Because you are loved, and you are restored, and you are redeemed, because we can never out-sin the grace of God. God always forgives, and his love never fails. It's his breath in our lungs. It's him who gives us life. It's him who gives us purpose and meaning and resources and joy. God's love does not depend on your character. It depends on his. And he is faithful. He is faithful. The second thing I think that is necessary in following Jesus is courage. Because following Jesus, truly following Jesus, is dangerous. Look at what he tells Peter. He tells Peter how he's going to die. How's that for a breakfast pep talk, hey? Verse 18, very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and you went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Gabrielle and I are very close to that point right now. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And he said to him, follow me. Follow me. That's what he said to Peter. One of the questions biblical scholars will ask at this point is this a prediction of Jesus' death, or is this kind of an ancient proverb? But Peter's death will be for the glory of God. And this recalls, I think, the teaching in the Gospels where God is to be glorified through the death of Jesus. In a matter, I'm just going to again quote George Beasley Murray. He just says, in a manner akin to the glorification of God in Jesus, though not to the same degree, God is glorified in those who lay down their lives for the name of Jesus. If you think back to what Jesus said in John chapter 10 about the shepherd giving his life for the sheep, then I think the logical extension of that is that Peter's commissioning here as a shepherd is actually a call to martyrdom. The final words to Peter, follow me, forms a transition to the next paragraph because it's evident in its meaning. In the first place, it's very literal. We pick that up in the grammar and the syntax of what's to follow. But when Jesus says to Peter, the picture that we actually get grammatically is that Jesus is getting up, and he's going to go for a walk along the beach, and he says to Peter, follow me. Rod, I'm going to head out to the office. Follow me. And you understand that at this point, I want you to get up and come with me. But there's an underlying bit to that where Jesus is saying, don't just follow me down the beach. Follow me to the very end of this road. Follow me all the way. Follow me to the gates of heaven. Follow me into eternity. Follow me. And Peter, bless his soul, he does. He gets up. But he's just been told he's going to die. And his cage is adequately rattled, and his humanity shines forth again. Look at verse 20. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. So John, not invited, but he's not going to be left out of this, is he? He's going to tag along. And of course, it's John who's writing this. And this is where you get to see some of the human personality in the biblical writers. And we've talked about this before. If John gets to take a shot at Peter, he doesn't usually resist. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who leaned back against Jesus at the supper and said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" And Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the believers that this disciple would not die, but Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you?" And so I hope you get the picture of what's unfolding here. They've had breakfast. The fire's still hot. They're sitting around. They're having their coffee. And Jesus wants a moment with Peter. And Jesus gets up and he says to Peter, "Follow me." And Peter gets up and they start walking, and John kind of tagging along, kind of in the back, not too present, but present enough that he can hear the conversation. And he hears Peter say to Jesus, looks around, sees John, probably a little annoyed, and says, "Well, what about him? Is he going to die too?" Jesus says, "None of your business. None of your business. You know, whatever I do with him, it's up to me. It's between me and him. It's got nothing to do with you. Focus on me. Worry about yourself. Quit worrying about other people." It's a little sharp, isn't it? One of the biblical commentators says, "The answer of Jesus is unexpectedly sharp in tone. It makes it plain that his will for his friend is of no concern to Peter, not even if that disciple is called to tread a quieter and less demanding way than his. If instead of the call of martyrdom is to be the Lord's will for the beloved disciple to remain till the Lord himself shall come, that should make no difference to Peter in the pursuit of his vocation." Jesus is calling Peter to a very specific life, a very specific ministry, a very specific end. And it is irrelevant to Peter's circumstance what happens to other people. When I was a child, every once in a while there would be a competition among siblings at the table. "Norman's not eating his vegetables." I was always so happy, because it could either go one of two ways depending on how the mood was. I could either get a sharp rebuke and a strong physical encouragement to eat my vegetables. Or sometimes every once in a while there was just this little happy moment of justice. "Keep your eyes on your own plate." Anybody ever say that to their children? Your kids ever do that? Can they ever start comparing themselves to what's going on beside them? And isn't that great when mom and dad say, "Mind your own business. Keep your eyes on your own plate." As the tattletale, you don't feel like you've had justice, but isn't that something, hey? Because we come back to "follow me." Who's the leader? Who are you following? Who are you setting your eyes on? Who are you pursuing into that holy wild, as Mark Buchanan would say? I hope it isn't me. Because I got to tell you, I've got all kinds of issues. I've got all kinds of problems. I read a book by a guy named Henry Nouwen called The Wounded Healer. Loved it. Because it basically says, listen, it's okay if you're a mess. God can still use you. I was like, okay, that's me. God can. So I embrace 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26. And you know what? You're a mess too, Mackenzie. Wes, you're a complete and utter mess. But it doesn't matter. Because I'm not following you, Wes, I'm following Jesus. And every once in a while you have something really good to say. Maybe we'll listen. And you know, maybe every once in a while I might have something good to say. Maybe somebody will listen. But you know, the eyes are on Jesus. The focus is on Jesus. That's who we're all following here. I hope. Hey? You need a certain amount of character. You got to get rid of the insecurity, the jealousy, and the pettiness. You know, sometimes you just got to step up and say, you know what? I'm in. You know, I love what you said about Joshua, right? Because it's easy for us to forget that it's him and Caleb that are saying, hey, boys, they might be all huge and big out there. They might all be 6'8", 320-pound offensive linemen, but we can take them. We can take these guys. And the other 10 spies say, we cannot do this. And they get busy. They start politicking pretty fast, don't they? They get into the camp. They start spreading rumors. Yeah, oh, it's horrible. If we go, we're going to die. And who's this Moses? And look what he got. And he didn't even get us bread or water or birds or nothing. And it's like, should we be following these people? Completely missing the point that it's God who's leading them. It's God who's going before them as a cloud by day and a pillar of fire at night. It's God they're following. Moses just following God. You know, maybe they can't see God. Maybe all they can see is Moses. Do you remember when we went bowling? Do you remember how I scored like a 67, even though I had 13 balls to hit down 6,500 pins, and I could only hit a few of them? You know why? Because I wasn't looking at the right things. Instead of focusing on God, we have a propensity to focus on all kinds of other stuff. We can even lose our way in church. But to follow Jesus, we got to put an end to comparing ourselves to others. Fear, doubt, insecurity, all those things lead to gossip and politicking and backbiting. When what is it that we are called into but this incredible adventure to follow this awesome God into this holy wild? I love that phrase. If you ever get a chance to read Your God Is Too Safe by Mark Buchanan, do. It's a fantastic book. To pursue Him. And you know, maybe we just look at some people who've just gone a little bit further down that path than we have. When I don't know what to do, I phone Herman. We've got Kurt. We got Wes. We've got Richard. We've got some fellows who've been around a while, who know the road, who know how to get us just a little bit further than we've gotten ourselves. And so maybe my children look to me, but maybe I look to, you know, a surrogate grandfather saying, okay, what do we do now? What do we do now? And they know what to do because they've been there. And they look towards somebody else. But everybody's always hopefully looking towards Jesus, because what we're ultimately all looking for is clarity. Following Jesus requires some understanding. Drop down to verse 24 with me, would you? This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. These things cannot be limited to the immediate preceding scene involving Jesus. Peter and this disciple, they're not the end of the story. Chapter 21 is not the end of the story. I think it probably relates to the entire gospel. This testimony, which John talks about, this testimony on which the gospel all rests, its authorship and consequently its authority attributed to the Holy Spirit. He says, many have testified. If John likes the number 3, he likes the number 7 even better. If you have your fingers, get ready to use them. Count with me. Many have testified in the course of this narrative, from John the Baptist to Jesus himself and his works, to the Father, to the Jewish scriptures, to an unnamed witness of Jesus' crucifixion, and finally to the Advocate or the Spirit of Truth, who we know is the Holy Spirit, and then this, the testimony of the disciple whom Jesus loved, who we know is John. 7 different witnesses testifying to the same truth. And this we, who is this we? And we know, is it the elders in the church at Ephesus? Is it the author himself? Is it the author and his friends? Is it the author in the church? It's probably the royal we know. We would say it differently. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows. John says, we know. It's an indefinite expression, meaning it is well known that. We know that this is true. We know. And then he goes on to say, you know, if everything Jesus ever did or said was written down, there's not enough libraries on the planet to hold it all. Which is pretty amazing when you think about how big some libraries are. But that's saying that, you know, we're just scratching the surface. And I think it behooves us to just acknowledge the fact that the overwhelming majority of each of the Gospels centers on one week in the life of Jesus. On a percentage basis, his first 30 years get very little play. You know, even his last 3 years, the majority of that story focuses on the last week of his life. Like, what are you supposed to know? What is your takeaway supposed to be here? When you read these Gospels, what are you supposed to be keying in on? Right? Right? You ever watch VeggieTales? Never? Leave. Get the ushers. Get this man out of here. How did VeggieTales end? Gabriella, how did VeggieTales end? Josh, do you remember that? It's that little song that they did at the end. Nobody? Nobody wants to admit that? Fine. VeggieTales had this thing that basically said, all right, folks, what's our takeaway today? And I suppose that here we are at the end of the Gospel of John, after a year's worth of trekking through that gospel. We did have some interludes, right? But you stuck with me for a year. And John is actually, it has this really elaborate, are you ready for this happy word? It's a very sophisticated inclusio. There's something at the beginning of the book and something at the end of the book that kind of says the same thing, and everything in between points to that. When you get to the end of John 20, he says, you know what, all this stuff was written down so that you would believe. When we examine the Gospel of John, we understand that one of the primary purposes or one of the primary themes in the Gospel of John is the deity of Christ. Do you know what I mean by that? He is trying to establish that Jesus is God. And this Gospel was probably written late, and it was probably written in response to a lot of heresies. There's no shortage of biblical scholars who actually think chapter 21 was tacked on the end after 20 kind of wrapped it all up, but who wants to debate that now? What are we supposed to take away from the Gospel of John? Jesus is God. God is love. And in order to experience God and his love and be with him for eternity, we have to believe. When John gets to the end of his Gospel, he doesn't let us just tie a happy little bow on it and say, well, that's good. He says, well, you got to understand, if you're going to believe, it's going to require commitment. If you're going to follow Jesus, it's going to require commitment. If you're going to believe in Jesus, you're going to be called to exercise some courage. You're going to be called upon to demonstrate some character. And you're going to be invited to pursue with clarity. You know, I know that Paul says that we see through a glass darkly, and I know that he says things like, you know, we walk by faith and not by sight. And that has led some to accuse Christians of being naive, head in the sand, unintelligent, uninformed people who just are leaning on the crutch of religion. I don't know if anybody ever listens to Paul Brandt, country western singer from Alberta. I will not admit to that very often that I've listened to country music, but I have. I just want that scrubbed off the official tape when we're done, Bill and Joy. But he's got a song where he talks about Jesus isn't his crutch. He's like his wheelchair and his braces, and he's like, he's everything. He says, because I'm broken. I don't just lean on Jesus when it's convenient. I lean on him 24/7. I need Jesus. And Jesus is calling forth this Peter, Simon, son of John, to follow him. But if you are going to follow me, Peter, or if you are going to follow me, Rod, or Matthew, or Deet, or Darren, you got to know, this is not the easy road. This is a long haul. This is a tough haul. This is not for cowards. This is going to require commitment. It's going to require courage. It's going to require character. You don't just get to give up when it's not easy and nice and fun anymore. And have some clarity. Understand the truth and the majesty of what it is you're being called into. And above all, follow me. Follow me. Jesus calls us to follow him into the holy wild, to join him in this great adventure, to participate in the greatest story ever told. But make no mistake, friends, Christianity isn't for cowards. Amen. Ben, would you come and lead us in our closing song?